Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Let's Hope the Weather Holds podcast. The name is very fitting today. I thought I would be able to take some time off this week and fly fish or go and hunt for chamois. But the weather in Invercargill in the South Island of New Zealand is wet and windy, so I just chicken out, basically. Today, I talked to Melinda Turner and Barry Riddler about Barry's E2M farm software, their ideas on the overuse of fertilizer on farms, their deep frustrations with how a maximum production model has become entrenched on many farms, and in the way the industry thinks. We talk about how more measured fertilizer use will mean farmers save money and how livestock will be healthier as a result. A heads up, the discussion is very New Zealand farm and farm industry specific. I would suggest anyone who is interested watch the video by John King on diminishing returns and read the links in the podcast bio, because this is definitely a topic to be investigated further. I think this talk will definitely ruffle a few feathers, but I see no use to leaving stones unturned and not asking questions around how the industry can improve. Industry that we all love very much. I hope you enjoy the discussion. Barry Riddler and Melinda Turner, welcome to the podcast. We're going to talk about farm inputs, fertilizer use today. Melinda, please introduce yourself. What do you do and what are you busy with at the moment?
Thanks for that. Nice to be a part of it. So my business is Farm Nutrient Advisory Limited, and I'm an independent fertilizer and ruminant nutrition advisor. So I advise clients on best practice in regards to fertilizer inputs, improving soil and pasture health, with the objective of optimizing animal health and production and maximizing farm efficiency.
And you, Barry?
Well, I'm really only taking a few requests from the odd farmer who sort of wants his system sorted out. And so all that I'm doing at the moment is helping occasionally to find out where the constraints are.
Barry, there was a big push to produce as much as possible in New Zealand, and that's sort of changed. But what led to the drive to produce as much milk and as much meat as possible, and to focus on intensification and high input models?
Well, there's two things. One is that basically the model that was developed through the late 80s and 90s into 2000 started to be used more and more, and that is basically an averaging model. And those sorts of models don't inform you well as to when you should stop putting inputs in. But the big driver for that, this model was doing really well in 2007, 8, and 9, and I did quite a lot of work for NAF policy at that stage. And believe it or not, that was in the carbon pricing. And so we were going well. And then, of course, the government changed and John Key came in. And along with Fonterra and Thera Spearings, the whole thing was they were going to double production by 2025. Now, I made a few statements on that, which put me even further behind in terms of getting any work with the dairy industry, by saying that it's impossible. You need an extra 2 billion kilograms of dry matter. What are you going to do? Farm all the ranges? And I suppose I'm a bit too direct. But basically, it was always an impossible task. But the more production equals more profit was the actual mantra. And unfortunately, I got on the wrong side of that, because I was saying no. And the work that I did with Lincoln University Dairy Farm proved this model was correct. That in actual fact, more production could be had if you did the right systems. But if you just tried to produce more by feeding more and more in, you lost money. So it was really that thing, double production by 2025. And everybody went head over heels, and MAF policy staff changed because some of them could see the stupidity of that. And nobody was looking at the economics. There's a diminishing returns curve. And unfortunately, all we had was averaging, which is the same as saying when you get pulled over by a cop doing 105, you can say, but I've only averaged 85.
I like that example about the policeman pulling you over. I've always thought if there's 100 kilometers an hour
speed zone? Can I drive 60 kilometers an hour for half of it? And can I then drive 220 or whatever? Sorry, there you can see how bad my maths are. Can I drive double the speed for the other half? What would they say? Something important that you mentioned is so the idea was the more you put in terms of fertilizer, et cetera, the more you get out and you're going to make more money. But you referred me probably a year and a half ago to a YouTube video by John King on farm profit, production pollution and risk. But you obviously understand a video about that explains the curve of diminishing returns. So maybe just explain the curve of diminishing returns, and then we can get on to how that ties into your philosophies and Melinda's philosophies.
Yeah, it's quite simple, but unfortunately, most people don't want to look at curves and things like that. So when you start adding, I mean, you know, we get back to motor cars again. If you put your foot down in a motor car, your acceleration will go up at an increasing rate until you get to a certain point when things like friction and stuff like that comes into account. And that curve starts to bend over. But when you actually exceed the 9,000 rev per minute limit, the whole thing breaks down.
Mm.
That, and before that, it may be that your engine mucks up as well. And so you're polluting the environment by all of the unburned gases that are having to go through. So if we again look at what a motor car does and then put that back into farming, exactly the same thing is happening. What you're doing is you're pouring more and more resources in to a certain area of ground to feed more cows at a loss. And so the diminishing return curve basically says, in the classic is a nitrogen application. It was actually a work done by Roger Ball in 1980 looking at response to nitrogen. And the response to nitrogen goes up, levels off, and then starts to go over the top. Now, the way that we then look at that is to say, okay, so we've got a marginal increase from this point to this point. Is that going to be profitable? So then what we have to do is we have to say, how many kilograms extra of feed have we produced from that extra kilogram of nitrogen? Nitrogen at the moment is, urea is about 466, 480 a ton. It's amazing. I ask every farmer I went to, what's your response to nitrogen? And they'd say, I don't know.
Mm.
If you get a 30-to-1 response, you've used all the nitrogen that's gone into the grass. If you get a 5-to-1 response, a lot of it is going into the atmosphere immediately. What does it take, 99? Oh, yeah, sorry, I'm thinking of the, yeah, it's $900 a ton. Sorry,
you're
I was thinking.
A couple of years behind.
No, I was thinking of the cost per kilogram of the
yes.
nitrogen that's in the urea. And so basically, what nobody has done, I said to one guy, okay, do a nitrogen trial. And he said, how do I do that? Like I said, just go down with the tractor, one side of a paddock, don't do it on the other side. Then the next paddock, do one side, don't do the other side. Then use your plate meter and work it out. And I went back about 6 weeks later and I said to him, what was your response to nitrogen? He said, I couldn't get better than 1-to-1, which means that all of the nitrogen that's gone on hasn't had to be used by the plant. And so it's gone into the soil water or it's collateralized up into the air. So you've got to have a response rate. The model that I use has got response rates. You can put whatever response rate you have. And if you go below 15-to-1, it won't use it at today's price. 15 kilograms of dry matter has to be eaten per kilogram of N put on the ground at today's price. Nobody's getting that sort of response except on prairie grass per head. So the diminishing returns curve should be looked at as the way to gauge whether or not to stop putting inputs in. In the good old days when we were getting doubling production, it didn't matter. All we had to do, because the mantra was double production, we just needed to double production. Nobody actually looked at splitting out how much grass is being eaten by the cows. And if all of the grass is being eaten by, say, 330 cows, and you put 500 cows on, you've got 330 minus 500, which is 270, what I term parasitic cows. They're not eating any grass. They're only eating bought-in feed. And if you then cost the board and feed at whatever it happens to be, but you'll always find that those cows are running at a loss unless you're at $10 a kilogram milk solids. So all of this can be done through this model here that I've got, E2M, Enviroeconomic Model. It's called the Enviroeconomic Model because it has got an environmental limit that you can put on there, and you can put a price on the cost of CO2, which is why I did the work in 2008, 2009, etc. So it is actually a brilliant model. It is far, far more intelligent than me, and SSI, System Software Instrumentation, were the people who put it together. They had no knowledge of agriculture, but what they had was an absolutely amazing knowledge of how systems work. So this one here works all the way through. So we can put in all of those things. So is that's more than enough probably, but
yeah,
nobody ever looks at diminishing returns. They just think, they're now aware that you can't just keep piling things in, but they don't know where the tip over point is in anything that is averaging, like Farmex or the other ones that are out there. You can work away at it, but unfortunately, it's an inductive process if you're using Farmex, where it is deductive if you're using E2M. And that means that inductive means it's trial and error. You keep working at it until you get something that you want. With the deductive one, you put the information in about the farm, and the model actually says, if you're looking for the best GHG, this is where you should be in terms of money and GHG. If you're looking for maximizing profit, this is where you should be. You don't have to infer what the next thing is that you should be looking at. It forces you, everybody's thinking of what, where, when. All that this model is looking at is why. Why are you doing it? It's costing you money.
I'm just going to, for listeners who are not aware, GHGs, greenhouse gases. Melinda, I'm going to, when I get to talking about animal nutrition, I'm also going to ask the diminishing returns question to you. Barry, so you go and have talks to farmers and you tell them they can use less inputs and make more money. What's the usual reaction on that?
Most farmers don't want to hear anymore because they don't believe me. I had one guy who was in the business of, he was controlling a lot of farms, or about to, and I took him through the model and that sort of thing I just said to you. And about three quarters of the way looking at the model, he just stood up and says, "Don't believe anything you've said. None of my training and none of my teaching has told me that you're right." And he got up and walked out. And this is the other issue. You see, it's become too hard for students to, not too hard, but they're not being taught systems anymore. They're being taught things which, like animal production or soils. But we sort of need people like Melinda to actually link up the soils with the pastures, with the cows, with the production, and then we need agricultural economics, not gross margins. We need agricultural economics to link all of that back to get the most profitable point. And the E2M does almost all of that. It can't do the soil stuff, and that's where I rely on people like Melinda, or the farmers will, to get the best out of that. But basically, it's simple to do a nitrogen trial, and there are so many farmers who are just pouring money into putting nitrogen on, and they see a response. But that response, in terms of green, that response may not be enough to pay for the cost of the urea and the application of it. And it's certainly, in the future, we shouldn't be doing it because of the greenhouse gas that is being emitted, both being volatilized and being sucked into or going into the soil. We've created a huge problem in dairying because of averaging. We've got to stop thinking of averages.
So basically you're saying in a nutshell is you're putting on, I'm just going to randomly pick numbers from the air. You're putting on, let's say, 100 kilograms of fertilizer. But if you put on 60 kilograms for just something I'm just grabbing out of the air again,
yep,
would have had the same effect, so that there's a certain point where that extra fertilizer is not affecting growth at all, or not really affecting growth. It might be slightly affecting it. And then from that point of the extra fertilizer, you're just losing money because you've put in something that has no reaction at all. And then you're obviously having more greenhouse gases.
Yes, that's right. Okay. No money, less money and pollution. And so the taxpayer and the ratepayer is then burdened with fixing up the issues that have been caused by getting this more production. So the argument for more production was it earns overseas funds. But we've got to look at the whole system. It may be earning overseas funds, but it's costing us internally to fix up all of the mess, not just from, believe me, it's not just farmers. We live above the Ahuriri Lagoon here in Napier. And basically, there's a whole lot of sewage goes in there from time to time. I'm sure it must be, because it has just deteriorated over the years. If, in fact, farmers get fined for dumping stuff into waterways, so it should be internally in New Zealand as well. Some of those people on the council should be held to account.
Yeah, and I think from, like, currently we've obviously got a lot of regulation coming in and a lot of, I guess, fear from farmers that they can't farm under the regulation. But the reality is the regulations are going to continue getting tougher and tougher, as Barry says, because they're trying to now rectify the mess we're in. But the farmers are encouraged to go down that track where we are polluting for no reason, rhyme or reason. There's no profitable perspective. It doesn't help production in the long run. And these regulations are kind of covering all that up when it's an industry-driven sales sort of motive, really, to sell all of this product that's unnecessary. And again, these sales reps, I'm yet to hear any sales rep that talks about diminishing returns. Are you Barry? But
no.
So the issue being is a lot of farmers are being put under pressure now. That really is unnecessary if those industry drivers were the ones to actually be held accountable, including the councils.
Have either of you seen that farmers use? I'm talking dairy now, but I'm talking about the overall industry. But farmers that use a lower input model as their philosophy, do they understand it better or not? Maybe Melinda, what do you?
No, that'd be the ones kind of ahead of the game.
Yeah.
So I mean, there are some smaller kind of 1-2-man band dairy farms that really don't need any nitrogen at all, and the odd season might be an exception depending on conditions, but for the most part their production and their profits are really, really tidy and comfortable. Mm. just with no input at all. And then you get the higher producing farms that while they still need nitrogen input, the ones who focus on the fact that if they get the soil health working optimally and they concentrate on the actual pasture composition, then that nitrogen limit is minimized straight away. And more importantly, the pasture composition and balance is more suited to what the cows can actually metabolize. So there's less wastage at the other end. With the issue we have is there's a lot of farmers who may want to reduce nitrogen and just cut it without actually focusing on the other issues and imbalances at hand. And when you're under a system that has been fully reliant on continuous excessive nitrogen inputs, you've got to know a little bit of the soil chemistry and the balance of the other aspects to make sure that it actually enhances your system. But it's a lot easier than most farmers even deem possible, to be honest. And the profit gain from it is immense. And the regulation, especially the likes of that 190 kg of nitrogen per hectare as a cap, I think it's ridiculous. I think it should be lower. but a lot of farmers don't think it's possible to even farm under that.
It's interesting that you say that. Something that's gonna I'll talk about when I we talk about animal nutrition, but I was at a dairy farmer in Southland who told me he put on 9 kilograms, only 9 kilograms of nitrogen last year because he was using biostimulants. So he says the 190 cap to him is madness. And then while I was a phytosanitary inspector in fresh produce, I was at a potato and onion grower in Pukekohe, and I asked him, you know, what does his soil test say? How much N is he putting on, et cetera? And he said, oh, he's never measured what's available in his soils. He just uses what the fert rep tells him to use. So he's been putting on something like, I can't remember exactly, but let's say 200 kilograms or 150 kilograms.
Probably about right, yeah.
Every year without seeing if all of it was being used. Barry, let's just talk about the overseer model. I don't know if I'm going to become excommunicated by the industry for asking this question, but you say there's some challenges with the overseer model. Just explain that.
Well, it has been, and I've been continually working on it. It's from my point of view, if you're looking at a sort of a broad idea about what the farm is leaching and what you should or shouldn't be sort of doing in some respect in terms of the nitrogen applications, I think it's probably the best that we can do as a model itself with the whole of New Zealand, because it's taking into account soil types, rainfalls, contours, and all those sorts of things. So it's quite, in that respect, it's quite a sophisticated model. But what they're trying to do with it is turn it into things which it was never designed to be, which is sort of almost like a farm management model. Well, it can never be a farm management model. And so they should stop spending money on it and concentrate on the pieces which are valuable to a certain extent. Now, Melinda's probably better informed on how that's used in the best possible way, but certainly they should not be extending it into a farm management type role because of the agricultural economics that goes with farm management, and it's just impossible to put the agricultural economics into that model. Well, I call it impossible. If you spend another couple of million dollars, perhaps, you know, I know that you still wouldn't do it. You've got to have a model which is reacting to what you're doing without you telling it to. Now, that sounds like artificial intelligence, but it pretty much has been with this particular, with the E2M. So I can force the model to put nitrogen on, and now all that I have to then do is limit the, or tell the model what the response rate's going to be. And from that, work out whether or not it's worthwhile doing. And, you know, Melinda's been quite good this morning because she's already talked about some of the nitrogen and the stuff like that with me. And I've already got some more ideas in terms of how the model can be improved. But this model has been pretty much funded all the way through by me and income from it. And SSI, System Software Instrumentation, they have been so good. They haven't charged me full costs. They say it's brilliant because they know what a good system is, and they put this together. So basically, we've got a model sitting here which can do almost the same. If I could link it up to the database of soils, farms, contours that Overseer has got, basically it would become an Overseer that is far more accurate than Overseer, because we've got all of the information that's going in there and all of the production, everything, each month of the year, each 2 weeks of the year. It's an interesting thing to realize that a model like this could be used for some very important work 2009, and then when the production equals profit, more production, more profit came in, how everybody just got, but basically everybody just did it. I was at a conference, I'm sorry, it's going to take another minute. I was at a conference for sheep and beef, and I said to them, look, you know, this modeling is very interesting, you know, it's got a long way to go, but it's showing me things, because I was, at that time, I was actually on our own farm, which was 460 hectares, and we had breeding cows and sheep, and basically I went down to this conference and I said, in all the work that I've done with the modeling, in terms of marginal cost and return. And diminishing returns, I'm not sure if I actually understood that now I come to think of it. I said, probably the best for a hill country sheep and beef farm is 135% lambing. Because if you go any further, especially if you're going up towards 180, you're getting triplets, you're getting print. And the model would suggest that the death rate, or you know, the growth rate that you get from them on a hill country because of the slightly poorer pastures is not going to be as profitable as only doing 130%. And this guy put his hand up in the audience. He had won the Men with Two, I think, Sheep Farmer of the Year award. And he stood up and he said, "Are you saying that more production doesn't always mean more profit?" And I said, "Yes, I am." And all of the guys around him laughed along with him. I still remember that vivid.
And I think it's definitely in all aspects of the industry, that lack of common sense that Barry's just referred to from the audience in that conference. But even from like Overseer, for example, I do it to tick a box because a lot of it obviously needed for regulation. But the practicality and the use of that to apply on farm is zero. And the model drives backwards from you put in your number of cows and sheep, and it decides how much pasture you essentially need to grow and ME, and drives backwards from there and determines all of the potential losses according to your inputs. But the actual ability to put your inputs is lacking. So there's very minimal soil test data that you could put in. It's solely based on an OSMP that is very inaccurate and has been proven so for our soils. An OSMP is actually tested at a pH of 8.5, and most of our soils are down in the acidic ranges. And so the effect a phosphorus ion has in the soil is very, very different in acidic soils compared to alkaline soils, which is where the OSMP has been devised from. So straight away, it's working on false data, really. There's no ability to put any more robust information in there. In regards to the phosphorus input, it can't, with the exception of RPR, it has no ability to decipher between solubility of products. So you can be working with other insoluble products that are then actually bulked in quite often with a DAP, and again has absolutely no relation to what the farmer is doing and what Overseer is calculating out. And then what I always get frustrated with is everything's obviously based on what the animal needs and calculate again using averages, etc. But there's no means to put herbage analysis or pasture or crop analysis in order to determine, well, actually, this is in your soil, but this is what's actually what the animal is eating. And a soil nutrient status and a plant nutrient status are very, very different, mostly because our soils are not well looked after. The fertilizer rents are really clogging them up. And a lot of pasture have excessive nutrients in some shape or form, and then deficiencies in others. And that's going to drive your animal production and what's going out the other end, etc. So the Overseer model is really very short-sighted in terms of the actual farm systems, as Barry touched on earlier. There's absolutely no integrated modelling at all. And it's not going to help us in the long run.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think the problem is that farmers were told this is the way to do it. And obviously you have to trust people who've put a lot of research into it. I also think the other thing I just want to mention, I don't know in your case, but I visit a lot of forward-thinking producers who are questioning everything and figuring out their own models. But Melinda, you're quite vocal on LinkedIn about you visited farm X today, and then you saw this, this, and this, and this won't work, but etc. And then a lot of people do agree with you and kind of applaud that.
A lot of people disagree.
So how?
Which means I'm doing my job well.
How are you? Would you say are you perceived in that industry? Like, because obviously you've got clients, right? But you know, Barry is at a place, you know, where he says he's, you know, seeing not a lot of people, but like, how are you then? Who gets you onto their farm? Like, people who are saying like, something's not working, I need a different view. Like, who are those people?
To be honest, who are ahead of the game, to put it as bluntly as that, and are able to think for themselves. And I guess, I mean, similar to Barry's, where if we just go rock up a driveway to any old farmer, chances are we're both going to get chased down the driveway pretty quick. I don't consider myself alternative on any means, and I don't consider Barry alternative. It's like, what Barry works with is, I want to say basic economics. Economics is not basic, but the philosophy he puts across and what farmers need to understand is really, really basic and common sense. And similar to myself, I promote good farming, normal farming practices, which are not done well in New Zealand. And we've been, by Beef and Lamb and Dairy NZ, farmers are continuously told to pat themselves on the back for leading the world. And the reality is, we're not as good as we consider ourselves to be. Some farmers are fantastic, but they're the ones who realise our industry isn't all that it's made out to be. And our research is always financed by those who have incentive to sell products. And it happens to be the research supports the sale of those products. Yeah. And similarly, all of these soil optimal ranges, they're all based on averages that are just useless for an individual farm. And you've got to treat farms and the farm managers and owners as individuals. They all have different baselines, they all have different variations and objectives, and it's got to be treated as such, whereas that is not what happens in our industry. So I mean, fertilizer reps don't like me, let's put it that way. I don't sell product that is not needed, and I don't sell product that is not going to work synergistically to optimize your animal health and production, and that's what we're farming for the most part, with the exception of the likes of horticulture and arable farming. If you're animal farming, you are farming the animal and focusing solely blindly on the soil, with no ability to understand how that then has a nutrient flow to the product out the gate, and the costs do that. It's just madness. Yeah. In my opinion. So I'm really lucky, like with LinkedIn especially. I mean, I don't mince my words, because the reality is, I'm not going to be working with every farmer in New Zealand, but if I can at least get some farmers that are currently ignorant to the fact that our industry is not working for them but against them, and they can open up their own eyes and just start looking at some of these red flags, then it's going to pay dividends, and their farm health, their animal health, and their profits are going to benefit as a result.
I assume once you've been on a farm and the maths start adding up, then farmers are sold on what you're promoting.
Yes, yeah, so I always give, because I mean, I charge an hourly rate and I charge travel, and that's a really foreign concept for farmers to actually pay someone for advice, because they are normally given so-called free advice from sales reps. And again, the cost of that actual product is typically extortionate and often not needed, or the wrong product, but it fitted the objective of the sales rep. So I don't expect any farmer to commit to paying me until they get an idea of how it works. And my mentality, I guess, and my thought process with integrating that farm system from soil through to the pasture and animal health and nutrition. So I always go to farm. They've given me an initial set of soil tests, herbage if they have it, which is not normally the case. And I provide a free report that just essentially pinpoints those areas where I can see as potential for improvement. And we discuss the benefits of doing that. And more often than not, from there, I'll be back in a couple of weeks to start official work with them.
I told you over the phone earlier this week, I visited two farmers this week. And the one told me he was seeing a lot of white line disease in his cows. And then he thought back, and his MT rate was going up. And then he thought back to the 80s when he was farming and he used less nitrogen and less urea than he was using now. And he didn't have those problems. So he eased back and he's using biostimulants. And he was also the person that said he used only 9 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare this or last season, and everything improved, and he made that association between what's in the soil and nutrition. And then the same week I visited someone who told we saw lame cows coming into the shed. I'm talking like just looking, we saw 6 or 7, and he said, yeah, they're getting a lot of lame cows these days, and his sons have taken over the operation. But yeah, they want to use less fertilizer, but he doesn't agree. I had visited the person who had made this association, and exactly the same problem on a different farm, but not having made this association. What do you, when you arrive typically on a farm, what do you see, and is there something typical that you see that you know you're going to have to correct in some way, or doesn't it work like that?
Yeah, I mean, with dairy farms especially, it's really quite generic, where you know they're going to have been using unnecessary excessive nitrogen. The soil's not going to be in great capacity as a direct result. And also from an animal health point of view, At times of active growth, like spring and autumn, when we're not moisture deficient, our pastures have really high protein levels as it is. And those natural protein levels are already above what a cow, a high-performing dairy cow, can actually metabolize at 18% crude protein. So we may have our natural pastures in the high 20s, so that's already 10% above what they can efficiently metabolize, and then they pour on nitrogen, which pushes it another 10%. And that's not only the nitrogen that's not taken up straight away leached, but the actual nitrogen that's in the plant can't be utilized. The cow wastes energy to spit it out the other end, and all of that energy to kind of circulate it and then get the excess protein and nitrogen out of the system, that's all circulating in the blood. And it does, it causes massive amounts of lameness, mastitis, just increased somatic cell counts. One vet that I spoke to a little while ago seemed to think a somatic cell count of kind of your 200 was okay. And no cause for alarm, and that's an indicator for somatic cell counts, are kind of an indicator of your severity of mastitis and potential and inflammation, and it should really be much lower than that. And when you're getting up at those thresholds, it's a big red flag that whatever you're feeding your cows isn't doing what it should do, and it's largely driven by nitrogen. And lameness, again, very similar. So I personally believe a lot of our cows are probably sort of not ruminating as well as they can, probably have subclinical acidosis, and again, has a huge effect on the actual ability of the cows to maintain health and function well. And it does, it shows up in lameness a lot of the time. And again, farmers, baselines of what's normal or what's acceptable is different to what I would consider normal or acceptable. And I'd imagine Barry is probably similar, similar mindset there. And again, you can even take that through to the likes of sheep beef farming, where in Barry, go back a little bit, Barry was talking about a lower land and lamb percentage is more economical, and I'd have to tend to agree, because we lamb in the middle of winter, which is when we have no grass at the best of times. Our farmers, again, we're in a very strict habit of set stocking, so you put the stock across the whole farm. You've got no spare area that is actually growing sort of behind to then go into. The ewes need the highest intake at that kind of late stage of pregnancy. Then they lamb in the middle of winter. They have to work hard for their feed. The lambs don't grow as well as they can because the ewes aren't as in good a condition either. And it's just a downward spiral. And then a lot of farmers use strategic nitrogen. They call it strategic. I call it reliant. Strategic stroke reliant nitrogen in winter, knowing again worst time to put it on from an environmental point of view, but they've got no grass, and that's not a management issue, it's not a system issue, it's a lack of nitrogen issue. And again, winter's not meant to grow grass, so your system needs to revolve around that. So there's a lot of things animal health wise, death rate of the lambs, the normal. I've just completed a Master's of Science in Livestock Health and Production, and I did that through the Royal Veterinary College in London, because again, the universities here have no capacity to link animal health to what happens on farm. And I did one of my last assignments was on our lambing system and the normal expected loss rates, which for our farmers are completely acceptable, absolutely horrified the professors on the other side of the world, because again, we definitely have a lot of room for improvement, but we do what's always been done and don't question it.
Is it as simple as saying I'm just easing back on nitrogen urea? Is it as simple as that or not?
From a sheep and beef point of view, to be honest, quite often it is. We just say we just don't do it, and it works really well. So it's something that they've done because they were told to do, and then they kept doing it, but it never benefited them. It didn't grow the grass it's meant to. It's not in the time of year you should have it, and questionable. I don't think any sheep beef farmer should be using nitrogen to farm, if I'm completely honest. But yeah, in that system, they don't typically put it on regularly enough that they've damaged their soil health, where the soil can't then look after itself and grow as it should. Whereas dairy farmers use so much nitrogen and so frequently, they have nearly sterilize their soil of the capacity to then look after itself. So you've got to wean it off, and you've got to look after the other nutrients that have been forgotten, which a huge part of that is calcium and magnesium, which is crazy when you look at how much is coming out of the milk of calcium and magnesium. So yeah, a lot of dairy farmers, they don't lime, or they haven't limed for 10, 15 years, yet they're taking the calcium out the cow. And they're more worried about nitrogen and potassium, which are the two main culprits for your mastitis and your lameness.
Do products like Fishit or something like Magnify, like biostimulants, are they like, do you suggest things like that, and what does it do to the soil?
No, I don't particularly work with them, and that's not because I don't see value in them. I am yet to see any independent true trials for such products, and being an independent advisor, like if a client wants to trial it, we can set that up, and there's no problem with that, and I'll encourage that, and we can make sure we actually do it properly, so we know what we're paying for is in fact helping, and that could be something as detailed as measuring the biology itself, or you can be more practical in terms of your I don't like measuring dry matter because that isn't necessarily proportional to animal health. But if we look at both in the pasture composition and the improvement, and then the animal health improvement, and that's something I've been approached to do with a biological product to set up some trials potentially in the future, which will be good. And I'm going to be doing a couple on my own property. So for any farmers of mine who do want to go down that track, I've actually got a little bit of independent information and experience before I recommend that. And a lot of my farmers, they're typically what you would term conventional farmers. So I'm not a regenerative consultant. I don't promote the name regenerative. I think it takes away the fact that we're just trying to normalize good practice, and that good practice isn't done well when the industry leaders and the sales reps are working with the farmers. So a lot of my farmers at this point aren't quite in the mindset for your biological products, but I do have some organic farmers where we explore that side of things as well. So I'm by no means against it. I also am very aware there's a huge number of products that claim to do everything under the sun and charge a fortune to do it. So that's the other key factor there, is that there's only a couple of products that I'd recommend without the farmers needing to spend a fortune to do good.
It's been interesting seeing some of the regulatory bodies and grappling with terms like regen. But Barry, did you factor in animal health when you just started with this? Was it a purely economic thing, and is it now something you think more about?
It's mainly it's the economics, but you know, you were both talking then about shuffling the feed around, and from my point of view, if you can feed animals well, a lot of that animal health goes. We hardly had any issues at all on our sheep and beef farm. We swapped. In other words, we had beef, we had sheep, and so the beef would be on a particular part of the country during the winter, and then the sheep would go there. And so the worm burden was there was no worm burden. Yeah. The other thing we're talking about was basically calving dates, and the model is excellent for that sort of thing because it will not. What the model does is it links everything together. If you're going to cut lamb or calve early, you're going to underfeed your stock. If you underfeed your stock, it's going to cost you money because they won't grow as fast for a start, and they don't tend to keep growing fast after that. So what the model actually does by itself, you can put in a number of calving dates or a number of lambing dates. And then you can look at what the model wants to do in terms of adjusting the calving date to suit. So that's what we did with Lincoln University, for example. But the model wanted to go 2 weeks later than Lincoln University were doing, and we couldn't get that through. We also pushed there, although other people claim the credit for it. The model, there's a lot of credit claiming going on, that basically what they should do is they should run higher pastures covers, then that will grow more grass. And the other thing was that basically the calving should be a bit later. They've got irrigation, so there's no compelling reason not to calve a little bit later if that's going to ease the feed situation. And of course it did. And the supervisor of the farms, they were doing two weekly herd tests. He came back to me about 6 months later and he sort of said, look, I've been through all the data. And you're quite right. And I said, what on this time? And he said, all of the cows that calved in the second lot of the calving outproduced the ones who'd calved earlier. Now, also, of course, I get myself into trouble because I sort of can't help the little quips. And at one stage, one of the gurus in dairy basically said that the earlier you calve, getting back to this sort of thing, the earlier you calve, the more milk solids you'll produce. You've got to basically have more days before Christmas in order to get a high lactation. I couldn't help myself. I said, should we calve on January the 1st? Now, you see, they're not actually taking into account the grass growth rate that comes on any particular farm throughout the year. You've got to do what's best for your seasonal grass growth rate. And so the model takes all of that into account. You're talking a lot about nitrogen as well. And we didn't use any nitrogen at all on the sheep and beef farm because we had things, I think, fairly well suited to calve things at just before the feed came through. And the breeding cows to us were some of the most important animals to have on a sheep and beef farm, despite the fact that a guy at the time was in Northland was telling us to cut the heads off every breeding cow. But just last week, I don't like to mention his name. No, fine.
No, don't mention a name. Don't mention a name.
No.
We'll both get in trouble there.
He's actually been, he's been an advocate all the way through. I don't always agree with him, and a lot of people don't agree with me, but Doug Edmeys had a short piece in the New Zealand Farmer that was last week, which is page 6, November 2023. And I agree with him entirely. He's basically saying much the same as what we've been talking about in terms of nitrogen.
Yeah.
And so he's basically said that there's been very little improvement in farming in terms of pastures. We're using nitrogen as a sort of a way to do that, whereas we should be thinking of other things. And we've got to use the nitrogen wisely. It's best for you to read the little article itself.
Yeah, I think so, I read that. I agreed with him. I saw it on LinkedIn, yeah.
So that comes through there. So we've got to look at the impact of anything in terms of live weight gain. And so, because live weight or milk production, and so all of these tricky things that farmers do are actually working against them because they haven't thought out the full system. And that's where, from my point of view, I have learned more from this model that I put, putting it together. It's much, much, much smarter than I am. And basically, I've learned so much from it. And so a lot of the research papers that Warren Anderson, who was at Massey University, and myself, have written, and Peter Fraser, actually, who was with MAF Policy, he was one of the guys that really pushed to get the money. It's the only money I've got to put the greenhouse gas layer into it. And so basically, we've written a lot of papers from 2010 through to 2018, and all have been actively ignored.
Mm.
The last one, I sent it through to you, you won't have had time to read it. But the introduction to that was basically a rundown on all of the things that we should have been looking at in terms of deciding whether or not more production was more profit. And so all of those little pieces that make up the full system, you can't use averaging and then use the averages to try and do something to change a system. You can't do Farmer of the Year unless you actually know a whole lot of other things about what that farm is about, what it's doing, because there's a lot of papers from Australia, and one of them was bemoaning the fact that despite the fact that this guy got Farmer of the Year this year, he never ever appeared in the top 20 from then on through. And I just sort of lean back and sigh. It's a whole lot of factors that go into making good production. And it's a link between calving, lambing dates, amount of feed on hand, what the pastures are like, how you're treating all of those things. And that's why the E2M is where it's at, because all of those things can be modeled within this model. And if you get it wrong, it'll basically snarl at you, and sometimes it'll say infeasible. A lot of those averaging models, you can do a lot of things. It'll never come back and say it's infeasible.
Yeah, it will just say more. Good. This is the average. Good stuff. Well done. I want to ask something very uninformed that doesn't tie into this, but I understand well, this was the case in South Africa. The calving and lambing dates were directly tied to the Christmas market when you want those.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously there's some for, is that the case here also? And that you kind of now you're accounting, wow, we want to put that meat on the plate or yeah.
Within the E2M, I can change the schedules every 2 weeks.
Okay.
Yeah, so if yeah. if in fact there is a, let me put it this way, a consistent schedule increase for getting early lamb in, and I put it in, it may change the lambing date to ensure that we get there, but that's given that they have to grow at the same time. So there's a combination of things that have to be put into that model. Otherwise, it just sort of says, not going to do it. So every 2 weeks, we can easily do it. It's all graphical. So you can just put in a $9 or $10 kilogram. So under those circumstances, the model will then rearrange everything else that is eating grass to make way for that one sort of system change. And it's not so difficult with sheep. It's very, very difficult, obviously, with dairy cows and beef cows, because you just can't change. You can change lambing dates by quite a long, a good period if you're feeding your ewes well over summer. But unfortunately, dairy cows are very difficult to change, to bring forward if you want to calve earlier. So yeah, the model is it's basically an economic and environment together. So if you don't put in any environmental constraints in, it will do the most economic of those things. The interesting thing is, if you then slot the environmental part into it, it still almost always will choose the most productive, the most profitable, because we really haven't done anything that will upset, because it's so efficient, we haven't upset the greenhouse gases as much. So if you do things which are going to be costly in terms of bringing in feed, or doing things like not growing your livestock fast enough, your greenhouse gas will increase. Now, seeing we don't have very much time, is one other thing which is critical, that the averaging is going to destroy. The averaging is going to destroy all the best farmers in New Zealand first.
Mm.
Now, when I say that, basically, Melinda's got farmers, and I look at farms where they are spot on. The model can't do much more for them, right? That means their greenhouse gas is at this particular level. If, in fact, we use an averaging, which is what we're going to do, an averaging to reduce greenhouse gases, those farmers will immediately begin to lose money because they're at the peak of efficiency. Yeah. Some of the worst farms in New Zealand in terms of production per animal and their management, they will reduce their greenhouse gases and make a whole lot more money.
And they won't understand why.
And they won't understand why. They'll say, what's wrong with you guys? This greenhouse gas isn't so bad. So again, we have Te Waki Eke Noa, and I was part of that with this particular model, and they couldn't understand it because they're so used to averaging. And so basically, it got, in the end, it got a tick. In the first case, it only had a 40% pass mark because people just didn't understand what it was doing, and it wasn't the same as their averaging models. So anyway, we finally got it past the hurdle. And so basically what they're thinking of doing is they've got about 10 calculator models, they call them. And the brilliant suggestion was, as far as I could see, what they were going to do was combine them. You're combining averages to get a better answer. Anyway, I just shake my head. I just can't stand looking at some of the things that farmers are talking about. My only hope is, we have got 9 people, hopefully, in a week's time, who are now getting into government who have got farming experience. Mm. And maybe they will look
Melinda, well, you're optimistic.
Melinda and I up, despite what MAF policy and MPI say, or MPI now, and actually say, hey, what are you on about?
Yeah.
And they won't. They'll be too busy doing other things. But I have tried every avenue there is to try and tell them that what's going on in New Zealand is not that difficult to fix, and we can fix it, in terms of making more money while we do it.
If you have advice for farmers, so we're not talking about, you know, about government and what they're doing, but if you have advice for farmers, both of you, of what to start looking at on the farm, Barry, in terms of the economics, and Melinda, maybe in terms of just soil health, which directly correlates to animal health. What would you look at, Barry?
It's really just balancing the system.
Yeah.
So do things where you balance the system out better. And if you can do that, you'll have a reward in terms of reducing a lot of the greenhouse gases that you're expending at a loss. And also your farm will just suddenly start to run and it won't be a headache anymore. So basically you've got to get a balanced system. And that sounds simple. It is not simple because there are so many interactions that are going on in a sheep beef type operation, and also so many interactions going on in a dairy situation where we have been, I suppose, brainwashed into believing that a particular system is best. And we've got to do this in terms of the pasture. We've got to do that at another time. No, throw all that out the window. Get something which gives you the most efficient system in terms of the resources that you've got. That's not that difficult to do. It is really quite simple to do, but not if you've got an averaging model. Yeah. It's impossible to do.
Yeah. Melinda, in terms of just things people can look at to impact their in soils, to impact their animal health.
Yeah, so I mean, fully agree with Barry, with the averaging just doesn't work for an individual farm system. And even from a soil test point of view, again, those figures are based on averages that have come across from the bulk of New Zealand, and everyone's farm is significantly different as our production levels. But I think the biggest area for improvement and really, again, very simple concept is that we need to integrate our farm systems. There is no benefit in solely focusing on a soil test and assuming those numbers are going to give you the production and the profits that you need. You're flying blind when you get a fertilizer recommendation based solely on soil figures, and you can guarantee it doesn't even have any relevance to the soil figures, and that it happens to be is the biggest profit margin product in the store, or the flavor of the month, what the reps get the biggest bonus or KPI based on. The sales are always based on tonnage. So if farmers don't have a look at their system in an integrated manner, they really are blind and throwing money down the drain. So pasture analysis, crop analysis, that is directly related to what the animal health and production is going to do. And you can relate that to the soil and you can see, okay, well, this is low in the pasture, but it's high in the soil. Why is that? And it's quite often because it's a liming deficiency, it's the calcium. That pH, optimal pH range, a whole lot of crock. Like there's most of our farms are running a calcium deficiency. I had a farm I was talking with yesterday, and they had a pH of 5.2, 5.4, 5.5, and they were never talked about having a liming program. There's no herbage analysis, but I highly suspect that their stock are not getting the calcium they need. And often our farms have way more phosphorus than calcium for stock. And that actually mines the calcium out of the bones. It gives them diarrhea because their intestine isn't absorbing as well as it could do. It's inflammation. And then farmers wonder why you've got these lambs that aren't growing as well as they can, and they're all shitty. And the same with the ewes. And it's because the fertilizer input is solely focused on the ridiculous averages of the optimal ranges, and there's no analysis of the actual pasture and the pasture health. From the pasture health, you can then see what needs to be done to rectify, one, the soil, and two, the animal health in particular. And until you acknowledge soil, pasture, and animal profits are linked, then there's going to be massive gaps in a farm system, massive areas of financial loss, all for the purpose of your sales rep bonus. And the reality is, we need regulation that sales reps aren't in control of advice because the advice given is wrong.
Now the question is, what's going to happen to me once we're finished with once these views are out there?
They're all self-employed for a reason.
Yes, probably right. That is actually part of the reason I am self-employed at the moment. well, it is. I've got both Afrikaans and Irish blood, and I think that is a concoction that you really don't need in any person.
The Welsh is a lot more vocal. So yeah. As you say, I am very local, vocal on LinkedIn, and it gets me in trouble. But at the end of the day, there's no point just agreeing with what's wrong.
Yeah, I feel the same. Barry, Melinda, thanks. I really enjoyed that talk. I enjoyed it. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks for the invitation.
Nobody else would listen to us.